This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello, welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today I'm interviewing Dr. Emily McGlinchey and Dr. Joseph Morning. Emily is a research fellow at the Stress, Trauma and Related Conditions Research Lab, based in the psychology department at Queen's University Belfast. And Dr. Joseph Morning is psychology manager at Verbal in Northern Ireland, which is a charitable organisation that develops creative language-based storytelling programmes. The topic today is harnessing emotional regulation skills. Emily and Joseph, welcome. Thank you for joining me. Can you each say a little about yourselves by way of an introduction?
As you said, I am the psychology manager at a charitable organisation based in Northern Ireland called Verbal. So we develop a range of different language-based interventions that kind of use storytelling to boost mental health and well-being. Before this, I suppose I did my PhD research actually focused on psychosis and kind of the early stages of psychosis development.
So my name's Emily McGlinchey. I only finished my PhD there in October of last year. So I'm very fresh out of the PhD. Kind of my PhD focused on mental health in adolescence over in Northern Ireland. As you said, I'm working now as a research fellow in Queen's University in Belfast. And up until I finished my PhD last year, I also worked clinically for a number of years as well as a low intensity CBT practitioner. So part of my role there was just implementing CBT based interventions to help adults specifically with a range of psychological problems like depression, anxiety, phobias and things like that.
How did you each come to be interested in child and adolescent mental health?
It all began in my undergrad. I suppose I started as a volunteer counsellor with Childline. So I worked there for 2 years, and it was through that kind of working with young people I got interested in it and realised that it was something that I wanted to focus more on. After that, I got into my PhD, and while my PhD research didn't actually focus on young people, focused on the very early stages of kind of the development of psychological illness, that kind of naturally drew me back to children and young people again, because for a lot of conditions, the origins can be traced back there. That's when these kind of unhealthy patterns of thinking can begin.
My journey was very similar to Joseph. So when I was doing my undergrad degree in Northern Ireland, I was working in Childline. As well as that, I was working in a local-based self-harm charity called Zest as well. So that began to get me interested in kind of what was going on by way of children's mental health here in Northern Ireland. Before I started my PhD, I was saying, you know, I worked clinically for a number of years in the area of CBT. And when you're working in that role, you know, I started to see kind of you get to see the massive stretch that services are under and kind of the long waiting lists. And I began to really become interested in what can we do by way of prevention or early intervention. So that led me to my PhD, which focused on kind of mental health in adolescence in Northern Ireland, with a particular focus in on emotional regulation and what that was and can it be harnessed as a skill, and, you know, what kinds of things happen when someone can't develop healthy emotional regulation skills.
I want to start with the basics. What is emotional regulation and why is it important to young people?
Yeah, so I suppose when you're talking about it, it can be good to start with emotions themselves. So like emotions, both bad and good, are a really important part of, you know, what makes us human. You know, we need them to contextualize situations. We use them to help us form connections with others. And they're really important for helping us understand what our own needs are, and they motivate us to make changes and they motivate us to navigate stress, really stressful situations. And as part of that, that's where emotional regulation comes in. So it basically is your ability to manage your emotions and your behavior in the context of the situation you find yourself in. Kind of things that involves are, you know, being able to calm yourself down when you're upset, being able to pause and think things through when you're very upset, and maybe after you've had a bit of time to think, adjust your expectations or adjust your motivations. And, you know, things like trying not to act on impulse and being able to handle frustration and anger without, you know, immediate outburst, for example.
So if a child or young person has poor emotional regulation or dysregulation, how will this typically manifest?
So there's no kind of, no two children are completely comparable. It can manifest in different ways depending on the child and depending on the context that they find themselves in. And I think before I give examples, it's important to mention that, you know, throughout our whole lives, you know, I'm sure all of us have had, you know, anger outbursts, or when we're young, we've had tantrums, or, you know, there's situations where we've got upset in a way that wasn't appropriate for the situation. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you have a problem regulating your emotions at all. You know, we all have times where we don't respond perfectly, especially in adolescence when, you know, you're still developing in so many different ways. But, you know, where emotional kind of dysregulation comes in, that's the, where the difference is there, is it's the frequent and intense experience of emotions combined with an inability to cope with them happening. Some examples would be, you know, difficulty understanding what you're feeling and not recognizing what you're feeling, you know, not really being able to put a label on that, frequently being impulsive, focusing on the negative, having real difficulty calming yourself down when you're upset, and that happening a lot, as well as that, you know, exhibiting or kind of displaying emotions that are too intense for a situation or not situation appropriate. Some people may use self-harm or, you know, self-medicating with alcohol and things like that to manage really intense pain that they're experiencing, and that would be kind of more at the extreme end of things.
You've talked about helping children find these skills, but what are emotional regulation skills?
Your emotions can be regulated in many, many ways, and there's a lot of research out there that kind of, if you were to sit and kind of go through it, you'll end up finding that there's a certain type of emotional regulation strategies that are seen as more helpful or adaptive, and there is another set that are kind of typically labeled as being not as helpful or more maladaptive in a way. Some examples of, you know, adaptive or more helpful strategies to regulate your emotions would be things like emotional awareness, you know, being aware of the emotions you're experiencing and being able to have a good understanding of that. You know, a lot of people struggle with being able to say, you know, I'm sad, or, you know, I was angry. A lot of people kind of seem to mix up thoughts and feelings. So if you ask somebody how you're feeling, they might say, oh, I feel stupid, instead of the emotion itself. It can be quite tricky to do. Another kind of adaptive strategy would be using cognitive appraisal. So basically all that is being able to take a wee bit of time for pause, think through a situation, and kind of control what you're going to focus your attention to, and try and look at what's happening to you or the situation you find yourself in that's distressing you from a more balanced perspective. I suppose some of the maladaptive ones, or ones that have been shown to be less helpful, are things like rumination. So that's constantly thinking about the negative, going over it over and over again. As well as that, you know, things like suppressing or avoiding your emotions. In saying that, labeling an emotional regulation kind of strategy as purely just a good thing or a bad thing is really tricky, because kind of the whole idea of regulating your emotions properly, you know, it all depends on the context and situation you find yourself in. For example, if you're having an argument with someone and you're extremely angry and your reaction's about to be very strong, you're about to have a really severe anger outburst in the moment, for, I guess, maybe in an extreme situation for your safety and the safety of others, it might be best to park those feelings of anger and calm down and come back to it later.
But how does one go about acquiring healthy emotional regulation skills?
It's never the same for two people. So I guess if you were to say it this way, you know, training someone, I guess, to regulate their emotions can be difficult if you're not used to it. But there's some things that people can be mindful of and practice. So there's some key points. So kind of the first one, first and foremost, would be to try, if possible, increase your own, I guess, emotional vocabulary and awareness of your emotions. And that can be difficult, but what that means is observing emotions as they are, without trying to change them or suppress them, you know, in the first instance. Practicing being able to label what your emotions are, saying them aloud or writing them down. This is tricky to do. So talking about them to a friend, a family member, or, you know, a therapist or someone you feel safe or comfortable with can be really helpful with that, because, you know, I talked about earlier, labeling emotions can be really difficult for anybody, no matter what age they are. You know, from my clinical work, I've often found that adults of any age, including myself, can have difficulty labeling what their emotions are. It can be hard to separate thoughts and feelings. So sometimes a therapist, if you're not used to it, is the best person to help you with that. You know, and it's important with that as well to try and not only label your emotions and being able to put a name on it, but to be able to kind of tease out the experiences or situations that come with a particular emotion. So that's a big one, trying to increase your own emotional vocabulary. A second one that's really important is cognitive reappraisal. And basically all that means is trying to divert your attention away from the negative emotion and try to think about it in a, from a more balanced perspective. That one can be quite difficult to do when you're in the thick of it. You know, if you're at a point where you're extremely distressed and you haven't had time to practice this as a skill, it can be quite difficult to do on your own. The kind of steps involved would be getting into a habit of taking a moment for pause, acknowledging what you're feeling. And as I said before, try and get a handle on what the emotion is that you're experiencing. Try and map, I guess, the situation or person or whatever it was that caused you to feel this way. Try and get a sense of how you in turn responded to what made you upset. And then, you know, try and kind of tease out the emotion. What were you feeling? How intensely did you feel it? And then try and weigh up the different ways in which the situation can be understood and try and figure out the good ways and the bad ways that the situation or feeling can be resolved, I guess. And because there's so many steps involved, that can take practice and it can take time. And sometimes, you know, talking things out like that can be really helpful to do with another person that you trust, because sometimes we have a wild tendency to just focus on the negative. It's kind of what we do as humans. You know, it's easier to look at the negative things than the positive things, especially when we're upset. And it can be really helpful to have someone else's perspective.
Okay. And if you did want to get professional intervention?
CBT in itself has a lot of problem solving and cognitive appraisal techniques within it. And then there's also kind of didactical behavioral therapy that aims to help you across a whole pile of different emotional regulation skills. By way of accessing those, the first point of contact would always be your GP, and then they can refer you on to whichever, I guess, severity level that was suited for you, whether it be, you know, early intervention like CBT or kind of a more intensive clinical program.
We've talked about professional intervention, but what about parents? Can they do anything to help improve their children's emotional regulation skills?
Parents can be in a really good position to kind of have a positive impact on their child's ability to kind of regulate their emotions. And there's a couple of things that they can do. Again, a lot of these parents do naturally. Do you know what I mean? So for a parent hearing this, they think, well, obviously, but it's always good to have a reminder. It's always good to keep these things fresh and kind of to renew the focus on them. First thing, I suppose the most important thing is establishing a type of relationship between yourself and your child that values communication, that values honesty, and that values sharing. You want to kind of build a relationship where a child feels comfortable talking to you about their emotions, about how they're feeling, and about what's happening to them. But that's not always going to happen. Again, children are entitled to their privacy as well as anyone else. And it's not something you want to force. You want to try and just create the relationship. It should feel natural. And sometimes that takes time. A lot of it is about listening. So I think it's good for parents to pay attention to how they're responding to their child if they come and decide to share something with them. The idea of being non-judgmental and listening. And once you've kind of established that groundwork, it's a great opportunity to start working on emotions then. So parents can help their child to understand what they're feeling. They can help to develop their emotional vocabulary so that they can have words to describe kind of what's going on internally for them. All of that work will facilitate this sharing. And again, they need that. That's something that they need if they're ever going to engage in kind of verbal sharing of emotions, which we know is a really positive kind of emotional regulation strategy. They need first to have that insight. So it's about developing insight, the encouraging sharing and responding appropriately whenever they do share. I think that can be scary for parents sometimes. I think they worry if a child shares something with them and they don't know kind of the right thing to say. I think that's something that you see a lot. But really, it's it's not about solving all the problems. It's about listening and making sure that your child feels heard. Another thing that they can do, they can work on some kind of practical skills with their child that can help them handle situations and handle their emotions better. So again, there's that idea of delaying response time to kind of their emotions that they're feeling. So that will reduce kind of impulsive reactions. Sometimes that's not really possible in the moment. If, you know, if your child is in a really heightened emotional state, it's not the time to start chatting. Well, you know, could we handle this better? It's better to, you know, go back after, once kind of the situation has been resolved, you can go back and you can talk about that. And you can talk about how they responded to the emotions that they were feeling. Was there an alternative way that could have been handled? Because that's a really important lesson to learn, that regardless of what emotion you're feeling, your reaction to that emotion is not inevitable. It can be changed and you can make kind of healthier choices. But again, it's about practice. So this isn't really a pass-fail thing. The focus should be on the child trying. Mm-hmm. And again, another thing that's really important is just to allow your child to problem solve. I think maybe for a lot of parents, this is maybe one of the least natural strategies. This is the one that a lot of parents might struggle with. It's about, you know, we have a natural instinct to protect our children. We want to keep them safe and we want to kind of stand up for them whenever we can. But they will encounter problems in life and they need to be able to develop the skills to do that. So the most important thing from a parent's perspective is to allow them to problem solve in kind of safer, controlled environments. Even if they aren't able to solve the problem, it won't have too many negative effects.
What about the role of education? Are schools a place where children can learn emotional regulation skills?
Yeah, I think so. Well, for me, from my, you know, from the research I've done throughout my PhD and, you know, my clinical work, I've always kind of advocated for teaching emotional regulation skills as early as possible, you know, just given how protective we know it can be. You know, I think emotional development should be a key component or, you know, a center focus of preventative strategies, whether they be in schools or not, that aim to tackle kind of the onset of mental health problems among young people. I really think that schools are one of the best places where such, you know, a preventative strategy focused on harnessing emotional regulation could be delivered. Well, you know, not everyone is in a position where they can learn from their parents or that they can get the support at home. At the same time, I think it's important to stress as well that teaching staff are in many ways stretched to capacity. And so if that was to be done, it would need to be, you know, sufficiently funded and sufficient teaching time allocated to that. You know, it's, you know, the same as physical education. I think both physical education and mental health education are equally important. This is a point that is kind of a key finding for my PhD, and it's a point that I kind of always come back to, that teaching healthy emotional regulation skills could be incorporated within the pastoral care programs already offered by schools. I think, you know, one way that that could look is, you know, we could teach by way of a class, teach our adolescents, you know, to label and understand their emotions, you know, learn them to problem solve through situations and practically apply the skills they've learned so that they can be used in times of stress. I think kind of such a preventative strategy could kind of incorporate a whole toolkit of strategies to help children regulate their emotions, you know, teaching them kind of things like stress reduction techniques such as relaxed breathing and mindfulness, help them practice those cognitive reappraisal skills that I mentioned earlier, because that takes a lot of time. And, you know, they could be doing tasks within school to learn how to do that. And I think doing it in schools as well, by way of a preventative program would be really cost effective. And I think it could be feasibly taught within a classroom environment if time allowed and if there was space allocated to the teachers to do that. Out there at the moment, there's some research that these kinds of interventions have been working really well. I think over in the UK, we have two. We have, I don't know if you've heard of the PATHS program. So that's a classroom, that's an intervention or more of a preventative strategy based within a classroom environment that, you know, focuses on those emotional regulation skills. And, you know, it's just nice evidence to see that these things can work and that they are working. And as well as that, there's another one called Super Skills for Life. That's geared towards more early intervention. I think that's more tailored to children or adolescents who have begun to experience anxiety or depression, but that intervention can be delivered in a school environment by school staff that are trained, and it encompasses a whole range of emotional regulation skills that we talked about, like, you know, stress reduction, emotional awareness, cognitive reappraisal. And, you know, the research that I've read based on that program shows that it's working really well. So I think that school is a really prime place for something like this to be done.
Talking about research, can you share a little bit more about your own recent research on emotional regulation? What have you looked at, and what are the key takeaways from this work?
So my PhD, I think I talked a little bit about it earlier, but I was interested in how common or what the prevalence of mental health was among adolescents here in Northern Ireland. And as well as that, I was really interested in what role emotional regulation had in relation to anxiety and depression. So where my research was a little bit different from research that came before, instead of focusing on particular emotional regulation strategies that we talked about earlier, like cognitive reappraisal or ruminating, I wanted to focus on emotional regulation ability. So what I mean by that is a person's ability or resources they have within themselves to regulate their emotions. So the things you have within yourself that affect what type of strategy you'll choose to regulate your emotions. So things like, you know, impulse control, your ability to engage in goal-directed behavior, your ability to actually implement and choose emotional regulation styles effectively. So what I did with that was I explored how emotional regulation ability varied among adolescents in Northern Ireland, you know, how it varied from those who couldn't regulate their emotions very well, who were quite emotionally dysregulated, to people that were, you know, average at regulating their emotions, and people that were really, really, I guess, proficient in it. And what I did with that information then was I wanted to explore, I guess, how protective, healthy, really healthy emotional regulation ability was versus how hindering emotional dysregulation can be in relation to anxiety and depression among young people. And what I found was, in terms of kind of the key take-home points, was that emotional regulation ability seems to play two roles in relation to anxiety and depression specifically. So those adolescents who were extremely emotionally dysregulated, they were at a significant risk for both anxiety and depression. And, you know, as expected, those who were really, you know, proficient in emotional regulation, they were, you know, significantly less likely to experience any kind of psychopathology at all. An interesting thing about that was those who were really, really proficient in regulating their emotions, they were significantly more protected, even compared to the adolescents that were, you know, average at it. And I think the key take-home message from that is it just goes back to that message that I was talking about earlier, that I believe that emotional regulation or emotional development should be a key component of preventative strategies that are, that want to tackle or combat the onset of mental health problems in adolescents.
Joseph, do you have anything you want to share in terms of recent research?
So our research, I suppose, at the minute is we're still in the middle of it. So we're at a really exciting time. Our kind of the intervention that we're working on, Well Read, is quite new. So it is. So we're at the minute, we're in the middle of running a pilot study kind of evaluating its effectiveness. So I'm looking forward to getting the results of that. I suppose it has been complicated, as has pretty much all research running at the minute. Because of COVID and kind of the current situation.
Right. Joseph, can you just explain what Well Read is, how it works, and also how parents can access it?
Well Read is, it's a website that we've developed with the purpose of helping parents to care for their children's emotional well-being and to help them develop emotional regulation skills. I talked a little bit before about how parents kind of feel about looking after their child's mental well-being. I think, you know, more and more parents are realizing the impact that they can have and are becoming more passionate and wanting to engage in kind of activities that can help their young people and help their emotional well-being. But I think a lot of the time they feel de-skilled and they're worried about having these types of conversations. They can be intimidating, and there's a lot of fear around saying the wrong thing or even just knowing how to start. Like, where do you begin to have these types of chats? So WellRead was developed to kind of help that, to facilitate those conversations, to give a structure that is at the same time enjoyable for the child, but also supportive for the parent. And it's based around a combination of storytelling and kind of targeted questions that the parent can use to spark conversations with their child about a range of topics around kind of emotional well-being and emotional regulation. So storytelling is a fantastic way to do this. We use it kind of for three main reasons. So the first thing is it's really good for kind of engagement. This is kind of marketed as a bedtime story activity that parents and children can take part in together. That works really well because it's a setting that's familiar for both parent and child. A lot of parents read regularly to their children anyway. So it's something that is kind of, it's got these connotations of being a comfortable and relaxing time, which is the perfect time to settle down and have some one-on-one time with your child, which is getting more and more difficult to have with the amount of kind of input that everyone has into their lives, like all getting busier. So creating that one-on-one time is quite difficult. So building it around a story is a perfect way to do that. The other reason that we use it, it helps young people kind of latch on to some of the ideas that are involved in kind of emotional regulation. The issue with discussing these things with young people is that they're all quite abstract concepts. The idea of thoughts and feelings and the impacts that they can have is quite abstract. And sometimes young people work better when things are a little bit more concrete. So the stories are the perfect opportunity for that because they contain an endless supply of different situations and different characters who are dealing with different things. So they're basically, they're like examples, they're like analogies. So it's a great way to spark conversation and to make the concepts real to the young person because they can see it and they're experiencing it through the story. So the way the program works, the website contains a series of stories that the parent can read to their child. As the parent reads, they'll be given questions along the way that they can ask their child. So these will explore kind of what happened in the story. So it could be like, how do you think the character's feeling right now? Why do you think they reacted in that way? Sometimes the questions encourage the young person to give the character advice. What could they have done differently? If this character was your friend, what would you tell them to do? So it's in a very natural and kind of low pressure way, it introduces these concepts in a way that can be really engaging for the child and also supports the parent. And it's a great way to kind of begin opening up and getting kind of a new insight into your child's internal world. Because a lot of the time these things just would not come up in normal conversation. So this is a great way to kind of begin that. And I suppose one of the things that I'm most passionate about when it comes to WellRead is that idea that it's building conversations around mental well-being into our everyday life.
And do you have the URL for WellRead?
Yeah, so it's www.mywellread.com. So you just log in. It's completely free. And it's been developed, at the minute, it's developed for parents to read to children aged between kind of 8 and 12. That's the age range that we've developed this for. But we're really kind of constantly developing as it goes on. So myself and my team, we're working on kind of adding other kind of psychological aspects to the website and kind of helping it to open it up for new age ranges and stuff like that. And we've also recently, because of kind of lockdown, we've built a small lockdown pack of 5 stories that are specifically exploring some of the issues that young people are dealing with during this time.
Emily and Joseph, what else is in the pipeline that you'd like to mention?
Yeah, well, I suppose for us at Verbal, it's all going to be about continuing to develop WellRead. We're kind of exploring different avenues at the idea of having it introduced into schools possibly as well. And again, we're also kind of continually developing the psychology side of the app.
Emily, is there anything you wanted to mention?
I suppose what's going on for me right now, I've just started my new job at Queen's there. I haven't been in it for very long. So what we're doing at the moment is very different to what I'm used to in terms of child and adolescent mental health, because that's kind of my background and where I come from. But now, kind of in light of everything that's going on with COVID, I'm doing some COVID research. So at the moment, my work is focused on doing some interviews with healthcare workers who are working on the front line at the moment.
Absolutely. Why is evidence-based research so important when it comes to children and young people's mental health? And how does one go about translating this into both clinical practice and policy decisions?
anyone who's kind of working in kind of psychology research or has a background in psychology at all understands, you know, evidence-based research is and should be at the center of everything that we do. It's, you know, the structure to our learning, kind of how we've been able to develop and progress so far with the interventions that we have and the ways that we're able to kind of help people with their mental well-being. When it comes to this type of research, especially preventative approaches, it's incredibly important. It's everything. Because the thing is, we live in a world of limited resource, and whenever it comes to securing funding and demonstrating it, when it comes to mental health, naturally the majority of funding goes towards people who are in most need of help, people who are dealing with the most severe symptoms. And that makes sense, and that's how it should be. However, there's evidence growing that a preventative approach or a preventative aspect, you know, is going to be central to our response to mental well-being going forward. Prevention is better than cure, and I suppose we need the research to be able to demonstrate that.
So I suppose kind of translating that to, I suppose, clinical and policy levels, I honestly think we're there already in terms of clinical practice. You know, I think these ideas of, you know, a culture of prevention and, you know, emotional regulation as a skill and, you know, a culture of early prevention and prevention and early intervention. I don't think that's new in terms of clinical practice. I think clinical practice is already there. I think at a policy level, it's more challenging because we're based in Ireland and Northern Ireland. I can only speak to kind of what's going on here, but we have a lot of really great research here, like a solid evidence base, and we've mental health policies ready to go based on this, that kind of getting home the message that a culture of prevention, early intervention is key to helping bring kind of the prevalence of mental health here down. But we have a challenge here in that we have no overarching mental health strategy here that's been implemented. So we have a lot of great research and kind of policies and, you know, key researchers and professors and things, you know, speaking about this culture of early prevention, but we haven't been able to kind of push through at a policy level yet. And, you know, in light of COVID and everything as well, it's going to be very difficult. But I think being able to push that forward, I think, you know, really we just need, and it's challenging, but, you know, researchers, clinicians, funding bodies, policymakers all need to come together. And I think if we were to get an overarching mental health strategy up and running, it would include, obviously, this culture of early prevention, you know, alongside, you know, improved and timely access to mental health services. And I think that would need to be properly embedded in every aspect of community and statutory services, you know, like we were talking about earlier, like schools, like voluntary community-based services or primary care or CAMHS or the higher up levels of intensity. And I just think that we really need to get kind of overarching mental health strategy up and running and properly implemented in line with what all the research is telling us. But there are challenges to that.
Finally, Emily and Joseph, what is your takeaway message for our listeners?
I suppose mine would be quite simple. And it's about keeping those kind of key aspects, those kind of key lessons of communication and sharing for parents, to keep that in the front of their mind. We've passed the time where mental health and kind of provision for mental health is thought of as sitting purely within the hands of clinicians. I think there's something that we can all do. And I like the idea of moving towards a time where everyone is playing their part in supporting their own and each other's psychological well-being. I think it's okay to not know all the answers. It's okay to sometimes feel out of your depth or a little bit confused or a little bit uncomfortable, but that's no reason to stop. I think it's good for all of us to, you know, look after each other a little bit more.
Thank you ever so much, Emily and Joseph. For more details on Dr. Emily McGlinchey and Dr. Joseph Morning, please visit the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled ACAMH.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.